Do you like a good rerun? Last Sunday, Sundays tend to be fairly long days for me, and last Sunday particularly so, because I had the privilege of speaking at the care center in Williamsburg, and so I had a chance to speak in the morning, go to Williamsburg, speak a couple times, and by the time I got home, I was just tired. So I decided that I was just going to vegetate for a little while, so I flopped down on the couch, and it is amazing how many channels you can have and have nothing left to watch. And so I was going through all of the channels till I came to the country music channel. No, it wasn't a concert, just in case you're wondering. It had nothing to do with music. It was a movie that I had seen several times before. If you've never seen The Blind Side, you might want to put your fingers in your ears because I might just spoil it for you. But The Blind Side is this incredible movie, this feel-good movie about this family in the South whose kids go to a Christian school, a private school, a high-priced school, and the young man is invited to come because he is, well, he's just huge and athletic, and they didn't bother to find out also homeless. And so this family takes him into their care, and they eventually get him a scholarship at Ole Miss, and eventually the show ends with the film from the NFL draft where Michael Orr is a first-round draft pick of the Baltimore Ravens. And I didn't intend to watch the whole movie, but before I knew it, the credits were going. Do you enjoy watching a movie you've already seen over? When my kids were young, they did. In fact, I think there was a time when I could have given you every single line in The Little Mermaid. And then there was a time I could have given you every single line in Cars, because we just watched it over and over and over. But it's not just kids. Do you know there hasn't been a new I Love Lucy in 50 years, and yet you can still find it? In fact, most of the programs that are most popular in syndication are Friends and Cheers and Seinfeld. They haven't made a new episode in decades, but there's just something about seeing something over again that we enjoy. This evening, you plop yourself down on the couch and you have your favorite movie, but they've done something to it. They started off with 45 minutes of credits and you can't change the channel. Are you still going to watch? We're making our way through the Bible, and this morning on our journey through the Bible, we stop at one of the most difficult books. In fact, it may be the place that if you've ever tried to read through the Bible, you stumble on. Okay, you get to Leviticus, and there's lots of rules, do's, don'ts, but you make your way through Leviticus, and then you're into a whole mess of incredible stories. Joshua, conquest of the land, the judges, even though sad sometimes, at least they're entertaining. And then you get to Samuel, and then the kings. And then you come to the book of 1 Chronicles. And let's be honest, there's some pretty big questions that I struggle with. Well, why does the author begin with all these genealogies? Why is there just so much repetition from stories I've already heard? Is there really a purpose? And ultimately, is there anything for you, for me? Let me just begin with the elephant in the room. Why in the world are there so many names you can't pronounce and you don't have any relationship to at all? Can there be any value in 9 chapters of one name after another? Before I answer that, let me put it back in its context, because I think the context is really going to help us answer that. We've looked at this chart before, but in the English Bible, it's divided up into 4 major sections. There's first of all the Pentateuch, or the Law, or the Torah, those 5 books that begin in the beginning God created and take us all the way up until we're on the east side of the Jordan River as Moses is getting ready for the people to enter. We then are in this major section, this historical section that we've been in for months, in which we will chronologically basically go through the entire history of Israel, from Joshua entering the promised land till eventually we will come back to the promised land after we left the nation in exile last Sunday. And then we come to the book of Psalms, one of the favorite books, and these books of poetry, and eventually into the major and minor prophets. But that's not how the Hebrews, the ancient Jews, divided it. I don't know if you're watching it or not. I've been encouraging you to go through. I came across this website called thebibleproject.com, and they have some, what I think are some really quality summaries of each of the Bible videos. They also have a fairly nice video trying to explain how we got our Bible divided the way it is.
If you open a Protestant Christian Bible and look at the table of contents, you'll notice the first three quarters is a collection called the Old Testament. If you look at the list of books, you'll see it's made up of 39 smaller works that are grouped into four main sections. The first five are called the Pentateuch, followed by the historical books, then the poetic books, and finally the books of the prophets. Now that seems simple enough, but actually it's more complicated and way more interesting. This arrangement of the books in a single volume called the Old Testament is a later Christian tradition that developed after Jesus and the apostles. In ancient Jewish tradition, these works were all on separate scrolls and were conceived of as a unified three-part collection called Tanakh. It's a Hebrew acronym for Torah, which means instruction, Nevi'im, which means prophets, and Ketuvim, which means writings. The Tanakh has the same books as the Protestant Old Testament, but they're arranged differently. The Torah corresponds to the Pentateuch, but the prophets consist of four historical narrative books and then the 15 works named after specific prophets. After this comes the writings, a diverse collection of poetic and narrative texts. Now this three-part design is really, really old. It's referred to in ancient Jewish texts like the Dead Sea Scrolls, the Wisdom of Ben Sira, even Jesus of Nazareth mentioned it.
And that helps for this reason. If I can go back to the bookshelf, if you will, the Hebrew Bible is divided differently. It begins with those same five books we call the Law or the Pentateuch, but then it comes to these four books. And if you'll remember, Samuel, Kings, and Chronicles in the Hebrew Old Testament were single books. Well, you find the first two in that section, then you get into the prophets. But if you notice that the latter prophets, what we would call the major prophets, are missing two. Daniel and Lamentation are not considered prophets, they're considered writings. I, to some degree, like the way the Hebrews did it. If you were with us when we were going through the book of Ruth, I love where Ruth is put in the Hebrew Bible. You come out of Proverbs 31, a wife of noble character. What does a wife of noble character look like? She looks just like Ruth. And that's where the book falls, in the Hebrew Bible. But if you notice, the very last book in the Hebrew Old Testament is not Malachi, it's Chronicles. In fact, I was kicking myself this week. In fact, I almost decided to not do Chronicles this morning, not because I'm scared of it, but because if you really understand the book of Chronicles, if I can throw this back up, trying to tie each of the books in the Old Testament to a particular time, and if we decide Samuel, Kings, and Chronicles are one book, the book of Chronicles doesn't simply span the time of the kings. It is the entire Old Testament. It begins with Adam, and it ends with the nation returning from captivity. The book of Chronicles, in essence, is a summary of everything we've studied. In fact, we may very well come back to it, because it's becoming one of my favorite books. Okay, that's really nice, Dan, but what's that have to do with genealogies? Well, let me return. If you understand, it is a summary of everything we've read so far. It's written to the people who are returning back from captivity. They've got some pretty big questions. Where do I live? Well, that isn't too difficult of a question. If you read Joshua, you know that Joshua, under God's authority, divided up the land. And if you remember the whole system that God gave Moses is the sabbatical system in which we work 6 years, take a year off. Then we work that cycle seven times, and then we have a year of Jubilee. And one of the unique characteristics of that year of Jubilee is the land went back to its ancestral family. Because the land was never owned by people, it was always owned by God. People just had the privilege of working on it. And thus, who owned the land, who stayed in the land, depended on what tribe you were a part of. If you're here last week, we talked about how the nation had divided into these two kingdoms, and the northern kingdoms were taken captive by Assyria. Assyria made its way down, and the only nation that stood against them was Judah. The 10 northern tribes were taken and scattered throughout the Assyrian Empire, and then the Assyrian Empire brought people back into the land. And from 722 BC, the 10 northern tribes, Reuben, Asher, Simeon, Issachar, Dan, Zebulun, Naphtali, Ephraim, Gad, and Manasseh, are for all practical ideas gone. That doesn't mean they cease to exist entirely, because a remnant of each of those 10 tribes had made their way back into Judah, But how in the world do I know what tribe I'm part of? Because if I know what tribe I'm part of, then I will know where I should call home. How do I know? I need a genealogical record. The people who are coming back desperately needed to know because it had been 70 years since the two southern tribes had been in Israel. It had been several hundred years since the 10 northern tribes. How in the world do I know what tribe I am from, so how I will know where I settle? Thus, we have 9 long chapters that tell you. But there's another problem. As you go through the genealogies, I don't know if you noticed it or not. I was tempted to ask how many people read it this week, but I won't do that. I won't embarrass you. But if you read it, you'll notice that there's a couple emphasis that gets an exorbitant amount of time. One of them is the tribe of Levi. Why? Because we not only need to know where we live, who's supposed to care for the temple? How do we know when it's my turn to care for the temple? Well, the care for the temple was divided. In fact, you'll read that as David is laying prospects for the building of the temple. He divides the Levites up into these different groups so that you have 2 weeks in the fall and 2 weeks in the spring to go and serve. Is it my turn? Depends on the calendar. Depends on you knowing what tribe you come from. But I think the biggest reason is, if we're honest, the question had to be asked, does God still care? I've just spent 700 years as slaves to a foreign power. I've just returned, and my nation is leveled. There's nothing worth living here left. Does God really care? He's forgotten about me, right? We've sinned too many times. We've offended him too much. He's just done with us. My guess is some of you have felt that way or may right now feel that way. What do the genealogies have to do with that? Well, there's a second line that is emphasized. It's the line of David. In fact, as you follow the line of David, what you find out is it's not gone yet. The descendant of David, the possible heir to the throne, the one to whom all of Scripture has been looking for, still exists. In fact, I was visiting with somebody before the service. One of the fascinating parts of the whole story of Israel is the genealogical records become an incredibly important part. They're housed in the temple. And in order for anyone to prove their Messiah, they have to be able to go to the genealogical records in the temple and say, "See, I am the rightful heir to David's throne." 70 AD, the Romans destroyed all those records. Today, nobody knows what tribe they're in. No one can prove their Messiah. But that's okay, because Messiah has already come. In fact, I would suggest the genealogical records were written to encourage these people coming back that God isn't done yet. Okay, well then, why does God choose to repeat everything? That's probably not that hard of a question if you open your Bibles to the New Testament. It begins with not the gospel of Jesus. It begins with the gospel according to Matthew, the gospel according to Mark, the gospel according to Luke. And in theological terms, they're called synoptic gospels. What does that mean? That means they basically tell the same story. They have the same incidents in Jesus' life. John is a little different, but it's basically the same story. It tells the story of Jesus. It's repeated 4 times. You come to Acts, and Paul's conversion isn't just told once, it's told several times. Why? Because it's really important. Should it shock us that these stories are repeated? I don't think it should shock us, but before you conclude they're repeated, I would suggest that Chronicles is far more like John than it is like any of the Synoptic Gospels, because there's some pretty major differences between the stories as told from Samuel and Kings and told from the chronicler, whoever that may be, such as, well, there's some pretty big omissions. As you get through the 9 chapters of genealogies, you come to chapter 10, and you get 13, 14 verses about Saul, the first king of Israel. And basically all we learn is he died in battle. It's almost an afterthought. Saul doesn't hardly have any spot, because Saul wasn't ever God's choice. He was man's choice. And thus you come. But what's really fascinating is the second half of the book of 1 Samuel. It has this whole long time of which David is on the run. David is fleeing Saul. Saul is trying to kill him. David and Goliath. And from that moment on, Saul's out to get him. That isn't even referenced. But the hardest part to come to grips with is if you come to chapter 20. Chapter 20 begins this way. In the spring of the year, at the time when the kings go off to war, Joab led out the armed forces. He laid waste the land of the Amorites and went to Rabbah and besieged it. But David remained in Jerusalem. I know what's coming next. I was tempted, but decided the words had become too small. I'd encourage you this afternoon, put up two windows on your computer, open two Bibles. Compare 2 Samuel 11 with 1 Chronicles, and you will notice that chapter 20 begins the same way 2 Samuel 11 does. And then David took the crown from the head of the king, its weight found to be a talent of gold, and it was set with precious stones, and it was placed on David's head. He took a great quantity of plunder from the city and brought out the people who were there, consigning them to labor with saws and iron picks and axes. And David did this to all of the Ammonite towns. David, as an entire army, returned to Jerusalem. Wait a second. Where's Bathsheba? This is the same story. This is the same time, the same conquest. Why does the chronicler just leave out Bathsheba and David's lust and David's sin and Uriah, who is in essence murdered by David? Why is that all gone? Is somehow the chronicler trying to rewrite the story of David so you'll forget? Think he's a perfect person? I think it goes to the purpose of the author. The purpose of the author is to encourage its readers that we are looking for a king in the line of David. Now, David wasn't perfect. In fact, chapter 21, we have a failure of David. It's a story of David numbering the tribe or numbering the soldiers. You remember the story, David says to Joab, count my soldiers. And Joab says, no, God has said never to do that. Remember, it's not the size of the army, but the God who's behind the army. And David says, I want them numbered anyway. And God becomes angry and he says to David, you can choose 3 years of famine, 3 months with our enemies, or 3 days at my hands. And David says to God, I choose that option. And God comes and sends his angel and he starts to judge the people and people die. And then he comes to the city of Jerusalem and he stops. Why does he stop? Well, we're told in chapter 21, verse 26, that David sees an angel hovering between heaven and Jerusalem. He's told exactly where the angel has stopped. He goes and he builds an altar. And there he sacrifices burnt offering and fellowship offerings, and he called on the Lord, and the Lord answered him. I know you thought Elijah was the first one to bring down fire from heaven on an altar. Nope. David did. Okay, that's a cool story. I don't know why they divided the Bible the way they did, but you got to come to chapter 22 to see what 2 Samuel doesn't tell you. It has all of that information. But what it goes on to tell you is the exact spot where that altar was is where the temple will be built. I don't mean to pick on Paul, but I will anyway. We've been, over the last several months, been having lots of discussions about there's a movement right now to suggest that the temple was never on what we call the Temple Mount. That's when they built the Temple Mount, they got it wrong. And I must admit, I have listened and argued just for the sake of arguing sometimes. But in the end, I've told them, what difference does it really make? Does it matter where the temple is? Yes, it does. In fact, Chronicles, as they are going back to build the temple, the author of Chronicles says, it matters tremendously we get the right spot. Because this isn't a spot chosen by us. This is the spot chosen by God. The whole point of David's sin is to help us see that God chose where the temple would be built. In fact, it's fascinating to me. If you read through 1 Kings, you'll see that it's almost as if there's no care given to how the temple is built. You read back in the book of Leviticus, and there's tremendous instruction by God exactly how the tabernacle should be built. It doesn't seem like there's any of that in 1 Kings. You come to 1 Chronicles, and it's clear God tells David, this is exactly how I want it built. See, the point of Chronicles is to point us to hope. In fact, if I can just throw out a bit of a comparison, the books of Samuel and Kings tends to be very biographical. It looks at individuals, whereas Chronicles, if you've read through it this week, you notice there's 5,000 of this family and 20,000 of that family. It's filled with statistics. Samuel and Kings spends a lot of time on the divided kingdom. In fact, the last couple Sundays, we've been bouncing back and forth. You don't even hear of them. In Chronicles, it's a personal history of Kings. It's an official history. And this, I think, is really the major difference. And one of the ones that I've struggled with. Elijah and Elisha were awesome individuals. Why don't they show up in Chronicles? I mean, I would love to have the book of Elijah and just read the stories of the many miracles he did of Elisha. But let's be honest. Elijah and Elisha were pretty confrontational. They condemned people. The whole point of Elijah's ministry was to get his finger in the face of Ahab and say, until you turn, God won't send rain. The book of Chronicles is not written from a prophet's perspective. It's written from a priest's perspective. It's not to condemn, but to encourage. To remind us there is, in fact, home. And the home and the hope are not tied up so much in the throne. In fact, there isn't one anymore. But there is a temple. There is a place that we can worship God. It's talked about sacred rather than civil. It's written years after the story is done as opposed to just immediately after it. It's not about rebellion and judgment, but it's for hope for the future. And it's not about man's failures. Chronicles comes and reminds us of God's amazing faithfulness. And yes, it has genealogies, which Samuel and Kings, for the most part, do not. So what is the purpose? Well, I think I can suggest that the purpose written to those who were coming back from captivity was to provide them a link to their past. This isn't a new nation. This isn't some new recreation of the nation of Israel with no connection whatsoever. No, no, you are part of a great story that has a glorious heritage. But you need to be reminded that the blessing of God is preserved by personal obedience. You and I don't think there's any Jews here this morning. You and I don't have a genealogical tie back. But Paul, in both Romans and Galatians, is going to tell us we do have a tie back. In fact, we have a spiritual father and, interestingly enough, a spiritual mother of Abraham and Sarah. And in fact, the glorious heritage of the Old Testament is our story if we've placed our faith in the same God of the Old Testament. And yes, obedience still determines God's blessing. Are we obeying? In fact, I think the book of Chronicles does help us as not just Jews coming back from captivity, but as believers living thousands of years after these stories, that we do have a tie backward. But let me ask a more specific question. Is there something I can take from Chronicles? My guess, of all of the books in the Old Testament, the one that I probably struggle the most with is 1 and 2 Chronicles. Is there any point? I would suggest there's at least two things I can learn, and I just want to throw them out. The first one is you can't miss God's sovereignty. I would suggest it's found in the very second word of the book. It begins, Adam. Seth. How many children did Adam have? I don't know. I am confident that he obeys God's command to be fruitful and multiply. We know that he lives some 900 plus years. 1,000 kids? There's no reason to believe he couldn't have had multiple births. Of all of those, we're just going to use that number just because I want to. 1,000 kids. Why aren't they all mentioned? Because only one of them would Noah come through. Only one of them would Abraham come through. Only one of them would Jacob and Judah and David come through. Was Seth better than the rest of the kids? No. God chose him. In fact, I think that becomes really clear when you come to the story of David in chapter 28. He's going to say, "Yet the Lord, the God of Israel, chose me for my whole family to be king over Israel forever. Now, you can get caught up in the books of 1 and 2 Samuel, and you could say, David is a man after God's own heart. He deserved to be king. He's an amazing man. God chose him because he knew what David would do, right? Before you answer that question, keep reading. He chose Judah. We don't have time this morning. We're not going to take the time to go back to the book of Genesis. If you're going to choose one of Jacob's 12 sons, you're not choosing Judah. Just saying. He would be at the bottom of my choice list. I'd choose Joseph. I mean, Joseph was an amazing man. God said, nope, I'm going to choose Judah. Why? Because he wanted to. He doesn't answer to us. He's sovereign. But I think if we're honest, that bothers us. I know that pastors can stand in front of churches and say, oh, God is sovereign and I'm happy about it. When I'm up here, maybe. Not so much when things don't go your way. Remember the context. They've been in captivity for 70 years for the two southern tribes, a couple hundred years for the 10 northern tribes. God's sovereign? That means he wanted me to suffer. He sent me there. One of the sermons I was listening to this week, the pastor began with the question, is it fair to look out for number one? I would say, absolutely it is. Who are you going to define as number one? My guess is most of you went immediately to yourself because that's the world we live in. I'm the most important person. You see it all the time. If I like something, everybody likes something. The song Andy led this morning, I liked it, so you all had to, because everybody has the same interests that I do, right? That's how we view the world. It all is filtered through the sovereignty of Dan. But I'm not sovereign. God is. God is absolutely sovereign, and he chose Judah. He chose David. In fact, as you come to the end, if you read 1 Kings gives this impression that as David gets old, he's laying with a concubine to keep him warm. He's basically out of his head, and Bathsheba comes to him and says, hey, aren't you going to let Solomon be king? And David says, oh, yeah, whatever. I really like you, Bathsheba. Okay, your son can be king. That's how it worked, right? No! It says here, of all my sons, the Lord has given me many. He chose my son, Solomon. Solomon was king, not because David wanted him, not because Bathsheba wanted him, not because Nathan wanted him, but because God chose him to be king. In fact, God is absolutely sovereign in everything. But even more than God is sovereign, God is central. One story, and we're done this morning. I think it really does capture the book of 1 and 2 Chronicles. It is a difficult story. It comes in chapter 13. It's the story of David bringing the ark back to Jerusalem, or to Jerusalem, rather. And begins in verse 2 of chapter 13. It says, he then said to the whole assembly, if it seems good to you, and if it is the will of the Lord our God, let us send word far and wide to the rest of our brothers throughout the entire territories of Israel, and also the priests of the Levites who are with them in their towns and pasture lands, to come and join us. Let us bring the ark back to us. Don't let this go over your head. For we did not inquire of it during the reign of Saul. Let me see if I can flesh that out a little bit for you. David reigned for 7 years in Hebron. David then eventually becomes king over all of Israel. And once he's king over all of Israel, he's unified the kingdom. At some point in the future, he brings the ark. Let's just say that's 3 years. So we're now talking 10 years. Saul was king for 40 years. As you read through the book of 1 Samuel, you'll read that clear back to the time of Eli, the ark goes out into battle, the Philistines take it, it does horrible things, they send it back, and the ark is gone 20 years before Saul. That means nobody has inquired of God for 70 years. Do you remember what you were doing 70 years ago? I think the vast majority of us would have to honestly say no, because I'm not 70 years old. And those of us who are over 70, I don't know if you remember or not, but let me just throw out a hypothetical. 70 years ago puts us back to 1948, just on the days of coming out of World War II. What do you think America would look like if there were zero churches in America since World War II ended? And this morning, I stood up and said, we need to get back to worshiping our God. That's what David's saying. God has been forgotten about. His very presence, the physical reminder of God's presence, is on the top of the Ark of the Covenant, and it's been gone for 70 years. And finally, David says, let's bring it to Jerusalem. And so they begin to bring it to Jerusalem. The whole assembly agree. And when they come to the threshing floor of Kidron, Uzzah reaches out his hand to steady the ark because the ox stumbled. And the Lord's anger burned against Uzzah, struck him down because he put his hand on the ark. So he died before God. This is a great day! And somebody dies. How do you respond? My guess is you respond exactly the same way David did. You get angry at God. How dare you, God? And then, once the anger fades a little bit, you start to get fearful. Wow, God is wrathful. And then you move straight to despair. How can I ever bring the Ark of God to Jerusalem? It's not worth it. I can't do it. And that's where chapter 13 ends. Chapter 14, David goes back to war. I guess I'll just leave the ark there. I can't do it. And then chapter 15 comes. And David opens up his Torah. And he starts to read a little bit. And David begins to understand that the Levites are the only ones who can carry the ark, because the Lord chose them to carry the ark of the Lord and to minister before him forever. And then you continue, and David says to them, you are the heads of the Levitical families, and you and your fellow Levites are to consecrate yourself and bring the ark of the Lord, the God of Israel, to the place that I have prepared. Bring it up for the first time that the Lord our God broke out in anger against us. He did not inquire of him about how to do it in the prescribed way. And so the priests and the Levites consecrated themselves. If you've been in church for a while, I'm sure you've heard that term consecrate before. It's one of those great terms that we pastors love to throw out. I don't know if it's because it makes us feel good that we're smart and so we'll use big words. What does consecrate mean? How did the priests consecrate themselves? Well, if you go back to Exodus chapter 28, Moses is very clear how you consecrate yourself. Moses says to Aaron, take one of the rams, and Aaron and all of his sons shall lay the hands on its head. Slaughter it, and take the blood, and splash it against the sides of the altar. Slaughter it, and take some of the blood, and put it on the lobe of your right ear, the thumb of your right hand, and the big toe of your right foot, so that whatever you hear is filtered through the blood. Whatever you do is impacted by the blood. Wherever you go is consecrated by the blood. The consecration required the willingness to stop and say, I am sinful. I cannot enter God's presence as I am. I absolutely need a substitute. A substitute that's willing to shed its blood for me. And the priests took a ram or an ox. Maybe the greatest verse in the book of Hebrews says, and every priest stands daily at his service, offering repeatedly the same sacrifice, which can never take away sins. But when Christ had offered for all time a single sacrifice for sins, he sat down at the right hand of God, waiting for the time until the enemy should be made his footstool. For by a single offering, he perfected for all time those who are being consecrated. sanctified. How in the world can Chronicles relate to my life at all? It's right here. David learns that in order for God to be central, he cannot enter his presence on his own. He needed a substitute. You and I cannot enter God's presence on our own. So God came. And he was willing to send not a great lamb. He was willing to send his one and only son to die for you. And if through faith you are covered in his blood, you are made perfect. David consecrates the priests. And David and the elders of Israel and the commanders of the units, 1,000 went to bring up the ark and the covenant of the Lord from the house of Obed-Edom with rejoicing because God had helped the Levites who were carrying the ark of the covenant. We don't know for sure. If you go back to 1 Samuel's or 2 Samuel's account, you'll find that it says they walked 6 steps, 1 step short of a full week, and they sacrificed. Some would argue the grammar suggests that they did that every 6 steps. I don't know if that's the case. But they sacrificed these bulls, they sacrificed these rams so that their blood can pay the penalty to cover the sin. But ultimately, a ram, an ox, isn't enough. We need an eternal sacrifice. The ark comes in, and so what do? Well, what they do is they begin by giving thanks. They give thanks to the Lord, they call on his name, they make known among the nations what he has done. And then they sing. They sing praises to his name. I know the book of Chronicles is a tough one to get through. But if you stick to it, there's this incredible reminder that all of us are sinners who need a Savior. And the Savior, the Son of David, came. So that this morning, some 2,500 years after it was written, we can look back and be reminded that, yes, God is sovereign. He's also central, not just of others, but of my life. Father, I thank you for the story of Chronicles. And God, I pray that we wouldn't get caught up in just this list of names, but that we would remember that you are sovereign, that you are the center of all the universe. And you have invited us to your presence, not because we deserve it, not because we can earn it, not because through some religious deeds we can somehow make ourselves good enough. No, we can enter your presence because the sacrifice came. Your son died in our place and rose victorious and sits at your right hand so that one day we will be in your presence for all eternity because of what Jesus did. As we now turn our attentions to the reminder, I pray that it would be more than just an empty religious ceremony, that it might well our hearts and our voices to gratitude, to praise, as we sing to your name. For it is in your Son's holy and precious name we pray. Amen.